trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful Davis State. Don, it's going to be 100 degrees or more for 5 days in a row. We got a heat wave coming, don't we?
Nope.
What do you mean, nope? Doesn't that qualify as a heat wave?
I don't know what qualifies as a heat wave in Northern California, Sacramento Valley anymore. But this has been very entertaining to watch for the last couple of days. Prediction, of course, higher temperatures for this coming weekend.
And I looked it up this morning, so it's got to be right.
There you go. Today's date is July 29, 2026. We're recording the show for broadcast on July 30th, 2026. And today's temperature is going to be 95 degrees. It's presently 70 degrees, at least at the Sacramento Executive Airport, which is what I have open in front of me. Humidity of 64%, dropping down substantially lower than that by the middle of the afternoon, with breeze coming in out of the south at 6 miles an hour. And all of these graphics for the next week show no clouds in the sky. What we have coming up Thursday, the day of the broadcast, this is for Davis to the Sacramento Executive Airport, is 94 degrees.
Wait a minute. It was supposed to be a hunt. Did it come down already?
Yep. Thursday night, 59 degrees. Friday, 99 degrees and hot. Friday night, 60 degrees. Saturday, 99 degrees and hot. That is substantially dropped from just a couple days ago, what they were predicting. Saturday night, 63 degrees. Sunday, 99 degrees and hot. Okay. Monday, 97 degrees and hot. Monday night, 60. And Tuesday, 97 degrees and sunny and hot.
Don, when I look at my phone and I look at the forecasts for it, you know, it's Friday is 101, then Saturday 104, 104. Yep. So why is it so different?
No, National Weather Service uses a blend of models. You can go to ventusky.com and do this yourself for fun. That's a great site with really cool graphics. It's fun to look at. You can sort of drag your cursor around and see how hot it's going to be in Vacaville versus Redding versus Fresno. You can go out 5 days, 7 days and whatnot. And the phone apps and Weather Underground always run high. This has been my observation. If it says 100 at the National Weather Service, right now Weather Underground is saying that on Saturday it's going to be 102, and on Sunday it's going to be 104, and on Monday going to be 104. And that's what phone apps were saying yesterday for most of the Sacramento Valley, including the Davis area, which often gets lumped in with Sacramento metropolitan area. We're more akin to Vacaville and Dixon. We get more coastal influence here. And as we get closer to the actual day, it's not uncommon for them to back off from those high temperatures on our side of the valley. So we do cool off more. We do get more coastal and delta influence. This actually came up recently in a conference I went to about trees. I know this sounds off topic, talking about trees and getting grants to fund tree plantings in different parts of Northern California, different parts of the state that are under canopied, as we say, don't have enough trees to shade them. And one of the things they look at is future heat indexes, future heat likely in particular quadrants of the state. And Davis, compared to Sacramento, doesn't qualify for some of the grants.
We've got lots of trees already.
That's not the issue. We're not as hot.
Well, that's good.
We think so. We don't qualify for some of the neighborhoods. They're showing these heat zones where they really think it's important to get trees planted. Obviously, part of that is local heat effect of pavement and concrete and things like that. But part of it is just our local and regional climate. And we get more coastal influence pushing in earlier in the evening, cooling things down a little bit. Yeah, it will be 104 in Sacramento on a day that we're going to be 99. And that was the pattern last summer very commonly. And it is something that we do appreciate about being on this side of the valley. So we could get to 104. Certainly Weather Underground is saying that's going to happen. But the National Weather Service is telling us we're not even going to break 100 this weekend. I think locally in Northern California, our definition of a heat wave is several days over 100. So I guess we're not going to have a heat wave. We're just going to have a warm event. How's that? And this
well, a normal summer fluctuation.
Yeah, and the normal high temperature, average high temperature for this time of year is 92 to 93 degrees. So we're going to be a few degrees above that in any event. What this comes up, the relevance of this is, as people are buying plants, they frequently ask, should I wait to plant this? Should I wait until after the heat wave to plant this? You know, heat wave defined, however you personally define it. Should I set this in the shade and plant it out maybe next Tuesday or Wednesday? And those are all
shade.
Yeah,
no shade.
Right. And it's not optimal to put the plant in the shade, but also I can tell you, if you put that plant in a little pot out in the sun, I have them sitting out there. I'm watering them in the morning before I go to work, and they need water again when I get home at the end of the day. So a 4-inch or 6-inch or quart sized pot is going to be drying out that quickly in this weather. Personally, I find it easier just wait till it's cooler as we get towards sundown, plant them, water them, check them each day, but they don't typically need water twice a day when they're in the ground. They don't typically even need water daily when they're in the ground, even in high temperature periods. Check daily, water as needed, and typically is every other day. So my experience, my lifestyle, going to work, not here 8 hours or whatever, that the plant might dry out at 2 in the afternoon and be pretty stressed by the time I get home. I find it easier to care for them in the ground where they're going to be growing than to keep them in pots. And putting them in the shade is just not optimal because the shade affects certain plants pretty adversely, actually, if they're a full sun plant. So it's a complicated answer. What we tend to feel like saying is, you shouldn't be out there when it's that hot.
Yeah.
Okay. So put the plant in the brightest shade you can or morning sun and get it planted as quickly as you can.
But you know, we're so lucky to have that cool down at night. We are just lucky.
Yeah, our average is 93 and our average low is in the upper to mid to upper 50s. But if we're 100 degrees, we're going to be down in 60 degrees or even in the upper 50s that night. So it cools off. And in my experience is, you put the plant in going into the evening, you water it in, it gets to go through the night. So it's going into a cooler, milder period than if you plant it, let's say, at 11 in the morning going into a hot afternoon. Should you shade the plant? We get that question a lot. It's fine, but it's not optimal. You know, what they're asking is, if I put it in the ground, should I put some shade cloth over it or something like that? When I'm putting out, let's say, a pepper plant in June and it's extremely hot, I have been known to take a folding chair and set it over the plant so that it's shading that plant in the middle of the day in a hot day for a couple of days. I don't usually do that. I usually find that as long as it's adequately watered, it's not necessary. But sure, shading the young plant a little bit during the first couple of days of establishment is fine. If it's a plant for full sun, you're going to be planting it in full sun, it will be okay. It's that first 2 to 3 days of transplant stress that we're concerned about. And it's not so much the direct sun or the heat, it's the watering. And so that's what really matters, is if you can give it the proper aftercare, put it in the ground. If there's any question about you walking out to your vegetable garden when you get home at the end of the day and checking on it, because it's almost sure to need water at that point, if there's any question about that, well, then maybe wait through until next midweek and maybe we'll be a little cooler then.
Buy your plants later.
Well, yes.
All right. Let's talk about something else. We have some events coming up.
We do. Yes. And of course, KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you folks to keep ourselves on the air. We appreciate that. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And I would like to say thank you, especially to one anonymous donor who gave a very generous contribution because they like the Davis Garden Show. Executive director sent me that note, and we really appreciate that. We just wanted you to know that. We have events coming up. The Arboretum Introduction to Climate Ready Gardening Webinar.
Webinar.
You can attend it.
Oh, cool. I can go.
That's right. Anybody can attend anywhere in the world. Interested in adapting your landscape to support biodiversity, conserve water, and thrive even in a changing climate. That's coming up soon, August 4, 6 p.m. To go to this one, arboretum.ucdavis.edu. Click on the events. You will scroll through at the moment, mostly acoustic jam session and folk music jam sessions, which are continuing. The Wyatt Deck in the Arboretum. Those are going on through. And as you scroll down, you'll find this one event, Intro to Climate Ready Gardening Webinar, August 4, 6 to 7 p.m. Event details are there for how to get in to the program. They do appreciate if you register for the webinar.
That's so cool, Don. Yes. Hey, you know, this is the end of July. And Well, I know it's late, but if any of you want to see me, I expect to be in Sacramento on August 1st because we've got the Harvest Day coming up. That's at the Fair Oaks Center. And then we've also got the Iris Rhizome with the Iris Society folks down at on McKinley. So maybe I'll see you if you're out on Saturday.
Head over there. Okay. And we also have a big event here in Davis this Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
The 50th anniversary of the Davis Farmers Market.
I feel so old. I remember when that got started. I mean, food cobs got started. You know, it's like, the 70s were a very active time.
Yes, they were. And this is one of the oldest and best, longest running, most effective farmers markets anywhere in the country. It is a big deal. It's one of the things that you take friends and visitors to when they come to Davis. If they're here on a Saturday morning, you take them to the farmers market because everybody who matters is there except me. I'm never there because I'm open at a retail nursery on Saturday mornings.
But I'm home sleeping in.
If you want to meet all the big wigs in Davis, this is a 50th anniversary event. It will take place from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. The event itself is scheduled from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., where there will be some speakers, including Karen Ross, who is the Secretary of Agriculture here in California. And then we'll have a bunch of special local dignitaries making comments, all that kind of thing. And then there will be a live cooking demonstration, live music for the rest of the event, special guests and family-friendly activities, a photo booth experience, a full collection of Davis Farmers Market archive photos. Boy, 50 years of archives. I might be in one of them. You might be in one of them. Yeah. Displayed as part of the Market Memory Lane. And if you happen to see Ann Evans walking around, thank her. Ann Evans was a founder, co-author and illustrator of Market Memories Cookbook, one of the leading lights in Davis for getting things like the Farmers Market and the Davis Food Co-op going. So thank you to Ann Evans for all you've done to make Davis what it is. Former Mayor Ann Evans.
Let's talk about tomatoes. Don sends me pictures of flowers each show. But this time, that's not a flower, Don. That's right. Is a big, luscious, juicy-looking ripe tomato.
Yes, that's the variety Genuine. Genuine, which I am more and more impressed by each year. I'm sure I'll be on Fred Hoffman's show chatting about how the tomatoes do this year, which varieties really stood out. This one's going to be at the top of the list, I guarantee. Genuine is they're calling it an heirloom marriage. That's a trademark name, where they hybridized two heirloom tomatoes to create a new hybrid. The problem with heirloom tomatoes for us in Northern California and interior Southern California and much of the Southwest, hotter climate areas, is that they generally were not from out here. They were from back there, mid-Atlantic, upper Midwest, places where it doesn't get 100 degrees and where we don't quibble about whether we're having a heat wave when it's 99 degrees. That's a heat wave in Ohio. And generally speaking, heirloom tomatoes, well, fun to grow, have variable yield. Well, this is a cross between an Italian heirloom, Costoluto Genovese, which I think very highly of, but it softens really quickly. It's a great producer, but it's got a specific, goes in the pot usage. And Brandywine, which is probably arguably the most popular heirloom tomato in North America, but never performs real well in the valley. Well, this hybrid has given you the best of both worlds. It gives you the production and the heat tolerance of Costoluto Genovese and the size and the color and the flavor of the Brandywine. It's a phenomenal hybrid. And I'm watching with interest as more of these heirloom marriage tomatoes come on the market. There's one called Marzanera, which is a San Marzano hybrid. This one, Genuine, we'll be talking more about it. Right now has about 40 or 50 fruit on the plant that are getting close to ripening. So over the next 2 to 3 weeks, those will be ripening. More are continuing to set. We haven't had super high temperatures on this side of the valley, so this hasn't exactly been a test year in terms of pollination and yield. Everything's setting really well. So maybe this year, you know, isn't the best for comparison in terms of total yield yet, but this one is at the top of the list for sure. High production, good quality. And as you look at it, it's a firm fruit. So it's not one that's susceptible to spoilage on the plant as Costoluto Genovese is, as an example. We'll be talking.
It looks funny to me because I'm used to tomatoes that are round.
Right.
And this is round on the bottom, but on the top, it's got lumps.
Lumps. Well, lumps would.
What do you call those?
I describe this as fluted. Yes, it has ridges and furrows.
Valleys. Yeah.
There you go. There's a term for it, but I prefer fluted. And these are pretty classic Italian style. A lot of them have this shape, and a lot of the Mediterranean tomatoes have this look. They're not perfectly round; they are ridged or fluted, and they're great for slicing. By the way, this particular one is very good for slicing. So those of you who like a BLT, this would be a good candidate. And the firmer texture is an improvement on the Castelluto Genovese. I love to grow that one. It's great for putting in a pot and making a really rich sauce, but it doesn't slice; it falls apart. It just softens too quickly. So this is best of both worlds. I think this breeder's onto something with these heirloom marriage varieties. We'll give you updates, obviously, on others. The other two that are way up there are one called Jet Star, which I got that one from Fred Hoffman, who highly recommended. And I absolutely agree. I counted 50 fruit on that one that'll be ripe within the next 7 to 14 days. And New Girl wins again. This year I did Early Girl Plus, Early Girl, and New Girl. In a row, you know, right next to each other, same irrigation, like my customers like to say. They're getting exactly the same watering. Well, probably not exactly the same, but they're on the same system, same location, same depth of irrigation, all that kind of thing. And New Girl, once again, is just slightly outperforming Early Girl. This is really funny how close it is every year. So which one ripened first? Well, New Girl by 3 days. Early Girl. Which one has more fruit? Almost exactly the same number, but a couple more on New Girl. Setting a little further into the heat last year, having a little earlier fruit set late in the season. So in every respect, and it looks exactly like Early Girl, both the plant and the fruit. As far as I can tell, they're basically identical in terms of fruit quality and flavor. So in every respect, just a little bit better. Nothing at all wrong with Early Girl. Nothing wrong with Early Girl Plus if you need that disease package that's been added to that one. But New Girl is outperforming Early Girl for the third year in a row under basically identical conditions. Those are the three we'll talk about right now.
Okay, so there's another picture of a tomato, but this one's not Don's. This was Fred Hoffman who sent that over, Don. And his comment was, I'd like to meet the joker who named this tomato Heatmaster. And the picture that he has sent is a tomato bush in a cage and lovely ripe fruit all scalded on the side.
Yeah.
All sunburned.
Yeah.
Heatmaster?
Heatmaster, right. And his plant looks good, although I notice the older leaves are yellowing somewhat. It's nice and full. I see about 20 or 30 fruit just visible in this picture. So you got a good crop on here. Well, what he's looking at is the yellowing kind of burnishing on the west, looks like the west-facing side.
Well, don't all tomatoes sunburn on the west side?
No, not necessarily. Certainly one named Heatmaster you would hope would not, because it suggests that it wouldn't do that, but then we'll get to that in a moment. Generally speaking, when we get sunburn, it does indicate that you perhaps are under irrigating. Fred and I will certainly talk about this. Drought stress on any plant, tomatoes are included, reduces the waxy leaf coating and the waxy fruit coating. I mean, that just thins out when the plant is not getting quite as much water. And so that would make it more vulnerable to sunburn. Any tomato in full hot sun, 100 plus degrees, is a potential candidate for a sunburn. Part of that is that as the fruit ripens, that waxy coating naturally thins down. So as it gets closer to being fully ripe on the vine, there's a relevant data point there, you're likelier to see sunburn if we have unusually high temperatures here in the valley.
So, okay, you said a bunch of things here that I want to clarify.
Yep.
Do different tomato varieties have different wax thicknesses?
I have observed that, yes. For example, Champion, Lemon Boy, just tough. They're tough skin. That's a big advantage as we get way, way late in the season, by the way. As we get into October, November, even December, and those are still hanging out there, those are two that I've routinely found perfectly good, healthy, unblemished tomatoes hanging on them in the first week of December. Lemon Boy and especially Champion. So that thicker skin, tougher skin, and that probably includes the waxy coating, is probably a big factor in their ability to resist decay pathogens and probably sunburn. So there's some variability, but most of what we see where we are seems to be irrigation related. However,
okay,
so you would think of variety called Heatmaster wouldn't sunburn. Well, again, we'll get back to that. Go ahead.
I thought when I heard the name Heatmaster before I saw the picture, I thought, oh, something that's going to set fruit at a higher temperature.
That may be what they meant. Okay, so this
anyway. So the other question I have of this is, I'm looking at it and I'm looking at the sunburn things. And I hear you say if it's going to be over 100, almost any tomato will probably sunburn. Right. But they're red. You could just pick them off and take them and put them on your counter.
Well, that is a strategy for dealing with a lot of things. I mean, we were having a problem with our very first tomatoes that ripened three, four weeks ago. The very earliest ones that came on down in the lower part of the vine. I have a big flock of turkeys that goes through my farm every single day. Sometimes it's one big flock. Sometimes they've split off into gender sorted groups. But in either case, when they walk through a garden, they can do a lot of damage. If they walk along and they see tomatoes at their level, they will peck them. All they have to do to destroy a tomato is just peck it once and move on. And we're losing a lot of them. And so we learned that if we picked them as they were turning color and took them into the house and put them on the counter in a 5 to 7 day period, they would ripen. And so we just started doing that to get ahead of the turkeys. Not only did it break up their pattern, there was no longer a food source for them there. We got a lot more ripe tomatoes. Yeah. When I mentioned this to some customers, they'll say, well, doesn't that affect the flavor? Don't you want it to ripen fully on the vine? And I'm sure that's probably correct up to a point. I would love to see, you know, maybe I'll do this someday. Pick some early, pick some if they get past the turkeys when they're fully ripe on the vine, have a taste comparison with someone with more sophisticated palate than perhaps you or I would have and see if it makes that much of a difference. A homegrown tomato is going to be really good no matter what. Yeah. But these are well ready to be picked. They're orange red. They're not fully red ripe, but they're close enough. They're probably 3 days away. And if we have a heat wave coming in, let's define it however we wish. We're going to be 99 to 104 degrees for 4 or 5 days. And you, like me, have a lot of fruit that's already gone off of dark green into the early stages of ripening. You might wish to pick some, particularly the ones on the south, southwest, and especially west side of the vine that might be open to direct sun. If you want to protect them from that direct sun, yes, you could drape some shade cloth over that side of the, you know, like on this picture. He could put some shade cloth to sort of attach it with clothespins to the tomato cage on the west side and perhaps protect them from any further sunburn if he really wanted to ripen them right there on the vine. To me, they're close enough to ripe. I would be picking these Thursday or Friday, so they'd be ripening on the counter during the extreme heat rather than out in the garden. That would be one way to get around this problem, and also problems with rats, ground squirrels, tree squirrels, and turkeys. Let's just get ahead of them by picking them before they're fully ripe. We've noticed they don't go after green or even off-green tomatoes, but they do go after them when they're fully red ripe.
So looking at these tomatoes, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 yeah. that are sunburned.
Yep.
But they don't appear to be rotting. I mean, they're not gushy or anything.
Not yet.
They don't have any holes in them. At this stage, when you walk out and go, oh, no, it's sunburned. Can you pick those tomatoes and still use them?
Yes, you can pick them. And these haven't sunburned to the point of actual injury causing bacterial soft rot or anything to get in. So I don't see decay organisms on there. So you could probably ripen these properly indoors and give them 3, 4, 5 days indoors. What I do when I've got, like, looking over at the counter, I've got about 30 tomatoes sitting there. When I'm going to give tomatoes away, I pick them underripe so that I can take them in firm ripe. So the person can take them home and let them become soft ripe on the counter. I learned this the hard way over many years of bringing in tomatoes that are fully ripe on the vine and watching them, you know, split as they were sitting in the car on the way in. So you will get fully ripe within 3 to 5 days. And these are ready to do that. This is something I really want to stress, is that these will be fine if you get them now. But if he leaves them out there going into 100 plus degree weather, they might get further sunburn than bacterial injury. He did comment the flavor on this one isn't all that great. So he's probably going to take it out. But let's get back to this name, Heatmaster. We make some assumptions when we see names like Heatmaster, Shady Lady, things like that, that they're
early girl.
Early girl, yeah. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean it ripens early, or does it mean it sets and holds early? Well,
or does it mean you can plant it early?
Right. Well, the main purpose with tomatoes is usually whether it sets at lower temperatures, like in the 40s, as many people around the country might be planting, and then dip that back down into low temperatures, it might affect them. Well, some of the early ones are okay with that. Or does it take less time to fully ripen? Does it only take 7 weeks instead of, say, 9 or 10 weeks? As
other, which would be great in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Yeah,
or anywhere that you have, you know, where you aren't planning until Memorial Day and you've got to get them done by Labor Day, then having that earlier ripening characteristic would be desirable. Heatmaster was introduced by Seminis Seeds right here in Woodland. They're a local seed company, seed breeder, that was purchased about 20 years ago by Monsanto for part of their conventional breeding program. They didn't do anything to these. They're not genetically modified. Monsanto always has had a conventional breeding program as well as a genetic modification program. And then Monsanto, of course, is owned by Bayer at this point. So you go to their website and they have a description and they describe it as tolerating, hot and humid conditions. So
humid means it's East Coast or
right.
You know, up in Canada or something. And when it's humid, hot means above 80.
Ask the people
who live there.
Yeah, well,
in that humidity,
yes.
When do you feel hot?
Oh, I'd say personally, yeah, 80 sounds about right. The Heatmaster, Seminis actually says on their website, Heatmaster has the potential to produce quality fruit even in hot and humid weather. The tomato is large, firm, and juicy. Growers will love the disease resistance package. Everyone will love the fresh taste. So my guess is this was for the Florida market. Mm-hmm. I remember reading years ago, 25, 30 years ago, that's, I think, about how long Heatmaster has been around, that they would have a problem growing tomatoes for the fresh market down in Florida, where they use hoop houses to get them in as early as they can. They're aiming for April, you know, May yields of fruit, so that they're trying to beat the market, get $4 a pound instead of $1 a pound. And they would have a problem when there's periods of very high humidity. The pollen, although tomatoes are self-pollinating just by wind and vibration, the pollen would clump. It would get stuck. It wouldn't move to where it needed to move to, and they wouldn't get pollination. And so this was an issue for a rather lucrative crop in Florida. My guess, since Seminis is a breeder of seeds for agribusiness, not home garden market as much as agriculture, I should say. They do have some, you know, Seminis owns Black Beauty eggplant. They own Early Girl tomato and so on. But this one was probably bred for agricultural production in a humid climate. Georgia, Florida, places like that where they can get very early fruit, but they do have that issue with high humidity. So Heatmaster, there's different meanings. It's not Sun Master. It's Heatmaster.
It's Humidity Master.
I guess, yeah, Muggy Master.
Oh, that's a good one, Don. Muggy Master.
Muggy Master tomato.
I think
we're onto something here. So my guess is they just came up with that name for that particular market, and the rest of us made assumptions about it. At the other end of the spectrum, there's the one called Shady Lady, which came on the market 30 plus years ago. We all assumed that meant here's one you can grow in some shade. I remember this.
Yeah, that would be logical.
What it really meant was that the foliage shades the fruit.
What?
Protecting it from sunburn. Okay, so Shady Lady had, as my understanding.
So it would be a tomato with a church hat.
A tomato where there's a density of foliage and wider foliage such that, and the fruit held more inside the plant, I guess, so that it would be protected. He wouldn't have this situation if he had grown Shady Lady. But for years, we were all thinking, oh, here's one that we could sell for people who want a tomato for the shade. We just assumed that from the name. It helps do a little digging into the breeders and what they're introducing them for and understand how regional the tomato markets are. There are tomatoes that are great for the California market. Out here, we grow, you know, it's the number one crop in Yolo and I think in Solano counties for canning. So we have particular tomatoes that are particularly well adapted here for that purpose. The southeastern market is a fresh market, is my understanding. So they're growing them for fresh sales locally. One of the most interesting tomatoes I'm growing this year is one called Hialani. I'll have to bring some in for our Hawaiian music producer at KDRT, because this is a tomato from Hawaii. It was bred for the Hawaiian fresh tomato market. Not so much for home gardeners, but for people who are growing tomatoes in Hawaii for sale there. Obviously, they're not going to ship them off the islands, and they can get a very good price for them. And it's proven to be an outstanding producer for me. The first year I've grown it, customer brought me the seed when she went to Hawaii. People travel, they say something like, I'm going to Turkey. What should I bring you? I'm going to Hawaii. I said, I always say the same thing. Bring me a packet of seeds, preferably tomatoes. And I've gotten some really, really interesting tomatoes this way. And this one called Hialani is a Hawaiian determinate, large fruited tomato that's very productive. It was bred for that market. So that's just emphasizing the regionalism of the tomato market. Some of these become great choices for us. This one looks like it would be a really good one for this area. I'm going to grow it again next year. Others, sounds like Heatmaster is one you're going to want to grow for your fresh tomato industry down there in Florida.
Okay, well, next up, we have a message from Charlie. Hi, Don and Lois. A family in our community garden asked me, why is our tomato plants not making tomatoes? Few flowers and the leaves are turning yellow. I said, did you fertilize them yet? They said, no, but we bought this from Amazon.
Uh-oh.
And it the pictures show a package and it's titled Urea, U-R-E-A. Oh, I had to steady myself when I told them, look at that first number and the next two numbers. And they were 4600. Oh, 40. Okay. Do not use this. It's way too strong. I call it the broccoli syndrome. When you use way too much nitrogen, you get these super thick green stems and the leaves are dark green, just like broccoli. Mm-hmm. But then you end up with a tomato tree and no tomatoes. My friend one time did the same thing that's what his tomato trees looked like. Every day, I ran the sprinkler on the beds to try and wash out all that nitrogen. It rained looked like it worked. I told him instead of using urea to buy Espoma Garden Tone, which is a 3-4-4 plant tone, it's just 5-3-3. Or just take a handful and scratch it in and use Alaska Fish Emulsion 5-1-1. Does this sound right? I'm not an expert, but I listen to the ones that are. So
thank you very much. Well, okay,
so the big thing is that 46 number. Yeah. It should be around 4, shouldn't it?
You don't need a fertilizer with 46% nitrogen for your tomato plants. That's for sure. That would
burn anything.
It could. Now, if you read the label, this is actually for home gardeners. Well, this brand is called Easy Peasy, which is not a brand I'm familiar with, but it appears to be a legitimate fertilizer company. And they tell you, I zoomed in for vegetables and flowers. All right, 2.5 cups per 100 square feet. Oh, that's
100 square feet. That's 10 by 10.
Yes. Per plant, 1/2 teaspoon around the drip line. Apply fertilizer on dry plants and water after application. So yes, if you follow that direction, 1/2 teaspoon scattered carefully around a plant and watered in, my guess is you wouldn't burn the plant. But how many people are going to actually measure that carefully? I've watched you guys fertilize your plants. You aren't measuring that carefully. And a 4600, if you go beyond the label direction there, yes, you're going to get monster plants. They'll be deep green. Let me tell you, they'll be impressive looking and they probably won't fruit as well. So it's been a long time since I've seen a packaged product of urea for the home garden market, but here you go.
What's really scary is they bought it on Amazon, which means it's out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can buy urea. Old guys used to come in and ask me if I could get them urea. Why don't you have urea? It's the most economical source of nitrogen. And I would say, didn't I have you for pomology? Aren't you a professor of plant science who actually knows about soils and trees and things like that? I would have no problem selling you a bag of urea. And it would probably last you years because of how little you would use. Because 4600, yeah, that's pretty high nitrogen. The next step down would have been sulfate of ammonia. This is a trip down memory lane here. 2100, 14% sulfur. So pretty good use in the Davis area because it helped to push the pH down a little bit. But 21% nitrogen for tomatoes, well, you're only going to use, let's say, a teaspoon of that. But even that, you're just pumping new growth. If you're feeding your lawn, young seedlings, things like that, those would probably be fine. But for an established plant, you're just going to get monster tomato plants and it will not increase your yield. That's for sure. I think Charlie's absolutely on the right track with any of those products that are 3-5% nitrogen. Oh, 8 or 10% is okay. More to the point, these are generally slower acting sources. There's usually a combination of an organic and a conventional in these home garden products. Conventional works more quickly. The organic works more slowly. So you get a longer feeding season. You're getting gentle, steady new growth, which it sounds like this person needs. older leaves yellowing, there can be various reasons, but lack of nitrogen could be one of them. Lack of vigor on the plant, especially if it's in a raised planter, you're in an area with lots of rain, which tends to leach out the nutrients. You will need to supplement those nutrients. And August 1st in our area, and probably where you are in Brooklyn, is a really good time to side dress a lot of your vegetables. Just take whatever fertilizer is appropriate to them and go ahead and either sprinkle it right around them and hand water it in, or just basically take a row of it and side dress, as they say, right down the row next to the existing plants. Thing to know about urea: if they did put too much of it on there, you did the right thing. Urea is very soluble. So even if you put on 8 times too much, well, the solution to pollution is dilution. I'll never forget my first training as a pest control
Water applicant. Is wonderful.
Water will take care of it. Yes, yeah, so just water, 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 because it is soluble. A lot of nitrogen sources, when they go into the soil, are immediately adsorbed, that is to say glommed onto, held onto by soil particles. So they stay there, and then they go through the process of breaking down through the steps that are necessary for the plant to take it up. Urea has to go through 3 steps before the plant can absorb it. It has to convert to nitrite, to ammonia, then to nitrite, then to nitrate before the plant will take it up. Very few plants take up urea directly. Many take up ammonia in the case of monocots, but tomatoes being dicots, it has to be nitrate. So it takes a week to 10 days after applying it before you see results. I would much rather have you doing a gentle fertilizer like a dry product. The Espoma products are fine, or light feeding with a liquid fertilizer like fish emulsion, or both, because these are so gentle that using them simultaneously wouldn't actually be too much fertilizer in this particular case. If it is something like urea and you put too much on, watering will generally get it through the root zone. Same thing is true typically of sulfate of ammonia when people use that one. If you water sufficiently, it'll carry it through the root zone and you'll avoid injury. Some of it will remain, but most of it would get out of the root zone. You'd avoid burning the plant, which is our big concern here, aside from overfeeding it and getting vigorous. You know, if we had a use for tomato foliage, it would be great, but we don't. So we're after the fruit. So you want to get a gentler feeding to get steady, sustained growth, not super vigorous growth at the expense of fruit production. If they want to know what to do with this bag of 4600 nitrogen, they might use it on their fruit trees. It actually isn't a bad way to fertilize deciduous fruit trees that you want to give some nitrogen to at the start of the season. Or sometimes people feed after they've put all their seasonal growth on and all their fruit has been harvested and you're doing your summer pruning, and they're no longer going to grow. They've gone into the summer quiescent period. They're not dropping leaves, but they're not growing. I remember many years ago, nitrogen studies found that if it was applied at that time, August, September, early October, depending on where you're listening, and watered in, so it was well distributed in the root zone, it'd be taken up by the plants, but it wouldn't stimulate new growth. We're talking woody plants that have a deciduous cycle here. And so they would store it and they'd get off to a better start in the spring. So if they want to use up that 4600, read the label carefully for fruit trees, and that might be the best use for it, since they probably can't return it. One of my employees went down to Atlanta, Georgia, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and said they had never seen so many crepe myrtles in one place. So in the southeastern United States, we became aware that it is by far the most popular flowering tree in that area, at least for the summer bloom, and they're everywhere down there. And crepe myrtles here in the Sacramento Valley, of course, are very popular. There are thousands of them around Davis, many, many thousands of them in Sacramento. And this does tie into, what are the pest problems you're dealing with right now? Crepe myrtles get an aphid. The crepe myrtle aphid came into the valley here 20, 25 years ago. I remember when it showed up, it slowly increased, and then pretty soon it was on every crepe myrtle that I looked at. Now, pretty much any crepe myrtle you see will have a sticky drip underneath the tree, just like pecans and lindens and certain other trees. This is just going to happen every year. You need to be aware of it. Crepe myrtle sales for me have dropped almost to nothing because we tell people this before they buy the tree, because we don't want them to buy the tree, put it in their patio, come back the next year and go, there's sticky stuff all over the ground. What do I do about it? Because unfortunately, the answer to
you wash your patio is unfortunately it.
Every day. With a pressure washer. That's what you do. Not just a hose. A pressure washer is what you'll have to do, because the systemic insecticide that people were using for this product is not legal to sell in California anymore. You're not supposed to be applying that to trees that are flowering anyway.
Right.
So right on the label, do not apply this to trees that are in bloom, because bees will come to the blooms. Yep. The systemic is in the tree. It will harm them. So you just have to be aware. If you're planting a crepe myrtle now, there will be a sticky residue under the tree. Some situations out in a lawn or on the edge of a landscape area where that won't matter, great. Because if you can allow that, you'll have aphids on there. You'll also have a lot of beneficials feeding on them. You'll be essentially creating a nursery for beneficial insects for the rest of your yard and your neighbors. That's very generous of you to make a place for lacewings and ladybugs and all that kind of thing. But I don't know of any variety that doesn't get the aphids. We are told that the hybrids that we've all been selling for the last few years because of their mildew resistance probably have a little higher susceptibility to the aphid. So you got your trade-off there. You don't get the mildew, but you might, you will get the aphid. If you want to avoid that, try Lagerstromia indica varieties such as Dynamite and see, but I'm not making any promises that it won't get the aphid problem, and you just need to be aware of that. So this is one thing that we're dealing with now. The aphids have really shown up, and any sample I look at, I can almost always show someone, look, a bunch of these are bloated. A bunch of these aphids are on the underside of the leaf. A bunch of them are tan colored. Some of them even have a hole, an emergence hole on where the aphid used to be. Now it's just a shell of a former aphid. They're being parasitized. They're being fed on by ladybugs. There is natural control occurring. The next question will be, oh, great. Will that take care of the problem?
Unfortunately, it will reduce it, but you're still going to be sticky.
It's already taken care of the problem to the extent that the environment will allow. So they've already come into equilibrium. Yeah, so what you say is correct. If you're going to have to tolerate that level of stickiness because there's already beneficials up there feeding on the aphids, they continue to have generations through the summer here. There's not a seasonality to them that is as comparable to the aphids we deal with in the spring, for example, which 90 degrees, they just stop breeding. These guys continue to breed into the summer, and you'll have them on there. So they're at the equilibrium they're going to be at. The only question is whether that's a level you can tolerate, and probably not if it's over a path, patio, spa, something like that, or a lawn area where your kids like to play, because it's sticky stuff and it gets on you. Way back in the corner, no big deal. I want to mention that one. The other thing we're getting lots of concern about right now is a leaf miner on citrus. It's just hitting a hard way over the last 7 to 10 days. On my own trees, I'm out there, the very newest flush of growth on some of my mandarins, every leaf is infested with the citrus leaf miner. And so, of course, people are asking about it. What it does that makes it visible, aside from the little train track thing in the leaf that you can see where the leaf miner itself is, from a distance, 10, 15 feet away, you can see something is distorted. And what they do is they're curling and cupping the leaves of the tender new growth of the citrus. They cannot oviposit on the older leaves that are waxed over. They cannot oviposit on existing older, darker green growth. But they do oviposit on the tender new growth, which is coming on citrus in a big way.
Do the leaf miners, are they always here when the tender new growth is, or is it a timing thing or a temperature thing?
It appears to be temperature related. They first showed up here about 15 years ago. They came up from Southern California, previously from Mexico and further south and east. And when they arrived, that was our first question was, is this a seasonal thing? How many generations do they have? How much do they do any damage? And the answer is I started jotting down when I first noticed them, and it would typically be the middle of July. So it appears to be temperature related to some degree. This year they were showing up a little bit, and then in the last week, so the third week of July, really hitting hard. I mean, lots of new growth affected by them. It distorts the leaf. The leaf is still photosynthesizing. It will still expand. It won't be perfectly smooth. It'll expand in a buckled, somewhat distorted shape because of the damage from this little critter that's in there tunneling around under the epidermis. It doesn't hurt the plant particularly. It doesn't affect the photosynthesis. It doesn't stunt the plant. It doesn't get into the flowers, of course. It doesn't get into the fruit whatsoever. It has no effect on crop yield or quality. So once you know that, this is just essentially a cosmetic thing. The problem is, even if that bothers you and you want to do something about it, it's in the leaf, not on the leaf.
So can you pick the leaf off?
Sure. Go pick all the leaves off.
That's why I'm asking is, yeah, like, is it going to happen for a while and then it'll stop happening and new leaves will be okay?
We continue to get generations of this starting mid to late July on and through September. So
forget that.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd be picking all that growth off. And sure, if you want to pick off the leaves, let's say this is one case. It was a kumquat in an ornamental urn right in the front. It was being grown as much for its ornamental properties as for the fruit. Sure, prune it off. Great. The new growth that flushes out will get infested again, but at least, you know, that won't bother you as much. But you don't need to. It doesn't help the plant or hurt the plant, particularly if you're removing some of the leaves. One thing you can do, follow those little tracks on the leaf. It's right there. The larva's right in the leaf. Take your thumb and your forefinger and press and you will kill it. You can squish it. So that's one thing you can do. You can kill the larva one by one if you're so inclined. When they finish, they come to the edge of the leaf, they emerge, they drop to the ground, they go through, they pupate quickly, and they do come up for another cycle. So we have about 3 to 5 generations of them here in the valley, whereas in the coastal areas, they start earlier and they go longer. So there is more concern in the coastal zones.
So how long does it take a leaf miner to mine from, I assume it has to come in the, into the leaf, yep, and then it starts tunneling.
Yep.
So, the first day, you won't see anything. The second day, how far will it have gotten in one day?
They go pretty fast. And within a week, you'll see them the pattern running through the leaf halfway. It looks like a train track. It's, you know, zigzag back and forth. They're very obvious. It's pretty cool.
So if you check your plant every day, you can squish the things as they get started.
Indeed you can, yes. And that would be very gratifying. More to the point, they aren't really hurting anything. If this turned into a beautiful butterfly or something, we'd be happy about it. But it's a boring little moth. Sprays. People ask about, is there anything to spray for this?
It's inside the leaf. How are you going to get a spray on it?
Systemic would be the answer. And we don't really want you doing that with your citrus, although commercially they do that. But yes, home gardeners, that would be the one. Again, that's off the market anyway. So even if you wanted to, it wouldn't work. So what you would spray for, if you're going to spray for anything, those of you listening in the coastal areas might look into this. If you're growing lemons and limes and they're getting affected, they're young trees to the point that they look like they're actually being stressed by it. You can buy pheromone traps. Monterey Chemical Company puts out pheromone traps that you hang in the tree. And when you find this thing showing up, the adult showing up, you start to spray. So first of all, it's to trap to make sure you're not just wasting the material and achieving nothing. Once they're present, you can spray with an organic spray called spinosad. Spinosad has become a popular all-purpose broad-spectrum insecticide. It is organic. It's certified organic.
That's that caterpillar stuff, right?
No, that's BT. And this is important to know. That wouldn't work because they wouldn't feed on it. They can't, you know, BT only works when the caterpillar feeds directly on it. They're in the leaf, so they wouldn't get at it.
Okay.
And the adult won't be killed in the case of BT. BT works on caterpillars only, not adult moths and so forth. But the spinosad will kill the adults as they come in to oviposit. And remember, you've got 5, 8, 10 generations, depending on where you are. So if you're going to spray, you trap with the pheromone traps. Once they're present, you spray every 7 to 10 days through the summer with spinosad. Most people don't want to do that. Some people are fine with it. Spinosad is organic, but it's a warning label, not a caution label. So it's an organic that's got some toxicity to it. You absolutely need to read the label of any pesticide you use regardless. But if you see anything above the caution label, warning or danger, you definitely need to read the label and follow the directions. And spinosad does affect beneficials. It's a broad spectrum insecticide. It's organic, but it still kills beneficials. So you'd be doing this if you thought your tree was being stressed or injured or stunted by the presence of these in the valley. They don't show up as early. They don't have as many generations. We just don't have as many problems with them. Even though it looks really bad, spraying doesn't seem like it would be super productive and not real effective unless you combine it with those pheromone traps. For the most part, I just say, remember, it doesn't hurt the fruit at all. It doesn't even blemish the fruit. I'd be real concerned about this if it made train tracks in the peel. That would affect my mandarin farm, but it doesn't. It doesn't do any of that. There is a peel miner I've seen literally twice in 20 years, and I see this leaf miner, you know, daily. So the peel miner would be a concern if it really became more established, but it just doesn't seem to be there. The leaf miner, cosmetic injury to the leaves, photosynthesis is occurring, doesn't affect yield, doesn't affect quality. Most people, when they hear that, go, oh, okay, fine, I can live with that. Great.
Well, here's a question that came in that I think I can answer. Can we grow loquats here? Yes. If you go indeed by the Quaker Meeting House at the front door, you'll see a loquat.
Was that a tree that was planted before someone wanted it for the loquats, or was it just a...
They planted a pair of them on either side of the door, and this was before the Quakers took it over, so it would have been in the 60s, 50s maybe.
So it might well have been grown from seed, in which case the fruit will be perfectly edible, but it will tend to have a high seed to pulp ratio. So
doesn't it have to have male and female?
No, they're self-fruitful, so that's fine. We grew them in La Jolla, and we made a point of getting selected varieties. They've been selected for a larger fruit with more pulp to seed ratio, because the seed is big, and better consistent quality of seedy. They reseed quite a bit, so loquats do grow here. The only thing you need to know is they are particularly susceptible to bacterial fire blight. They're in the Apple family. They're in the Rose family, the Apple branch of the Rose family. So they're closely related to apples, pears, pyracantha, cotoneaster, quince, things like that. And if you look at the fruit, you'll see the similarity. You'll see the relationship. And many members of that branch of the Rose family are hosts to bacterial fire blight, which is fortunately specific only to them. So it won't hit your peach tree or other members of the Rose family. It just typically goes to members of the Palm group. And I have seen half of a loquat tree killed by fire blight over a 3 or 4 week period in a bad fire blight year. So if you do see fire blight on your loquat, wherever you're listening, prune it out as quickly as you can. In the case of loquat, it's pretty easy to see what you're doing because it's a big bold leaf and the fire blight blackens the growth and you can see exactly where the infection is. So this is a case where I would go ahead and go out during the infectious period, go down several inches below the point of infection, prune that out, bag it up, throw that away, quickly wipe your pruners with isopropyl alcohol or bleach, I guess, to possibly prevent any spread of the disease. Be aware of fire blight on loquats. I've seen trees go years without ever getting it. And then I've seen a tree die. One of my neighbors around the corner, half the tree died 1 year and they ended up just taking the whole thing out because it was so disfigured by it. So it can be a real problem on loquats. Other than that, drought tolerant, tough, beautiful tropical look. Fruit's great if you happen to like it. Doesn't store real well. So it's the kind of thing where you're either going to process it or freeze it or something. And they produce way more than you can possibly use. But they are a very cool plant for this area, as well as, of course, most parts of Southern California. You'll have more sugar content in the interior, but they grow just fine along the coast as well.
All right. All about snapdragons. This is an article that Don has sent me. That's a wonderful article. But did you write this or did you get this somewhere?
I've pulled this information from different sources. The reason I mentioned snapdragons at the end of July is that the first week of August, we are beginning to direct seed into the propagation flats in our greenhouse. The long-stemmed cutting snapdragons. We will do some of the dwarf types for bedding as well, but I can get those from my bedding plant suppliers. But for cut flowers, for those of you who like to grow your own cut flowers, August to September is when you plant snapdragons, old-fashioned snapdragons. Once upon a time, snapdragons were planted in our area in the fall or late winter, pinched to make them bush from the base, and then you get these nice long shoots because they're long-day plants. They would start to flower as the days are getting longer. So obviously that's spring going towards summer, and they would give these great long stems April, May, and June. And then when the temperatures get into the 90s and above fairly consistently, snapdragons are done. But they give lots of bloom in the late winter and through the spring and all the way into just about the beginning of summer. You need to give those a whole head start. This is perhaps why they fell out of favor. They need to be planted here many weeks ahead of when they're going to be blooming, actually months ahead of when they're going to be blooming. You do the seed in August, you do the put the plants up into bigger pots and you pinch them in September. You get that flush from the base, you plant them out in your garden in October for bloom next April. And the pictures that I've taken of my displays of these are typically heaviest in May. The month of May is snapdragon month. They're absolutely incredible at that point. These are your old-fashioned long-stem snapdragons. They're 3 to 4 feet tall when they're in bloom. They open for a very long period of time because it used to be an important cut flower in the United States. A little surprised to learn, for example, there's something called UC hybrid. Apparently, the University of California was hybridizing snapdragons in the 1930s. Who knew? But that would have been for the cut flower industry, not for the bedding plant industry. I mentioned their long day. That means they don't initiate flowers until the days are getting longer. Many years ago, day neutral versions came along. This is true of strawberries and other, you know, photoperiod sensitive plants. A day neutral version comes along. That'll bloom whenever you schedule it to bloom. That'll bloom X number of weeks after you plant the seed. And dwarfer plants, only 18 inches. Some are only a foot tall and they start blooming right away. You can sell them in pony packs in bloom. You can sell them in quart pots in bloom and they'll continue to bloom right on through April and May. And in some cases, right on into the summer. So those are great. The flower carpet series, the Tahitian sunset series, these are all wonderful garden plants, but their bloom spikes are only like 6 inches long. And so they're not a cut flower by any stretch. And they're not a big thing in the garden. They're more of a mass bedding plant. Those are fine. You can plant them anytime. But if you're into cut flowers and you want to grow something you haven't grown in a long time, there's two that I would start planting August to September. Old-fashioned snapdragons, and you can find them at Johnny's Seeds and some of the other sources like that, that sell to the cut flower. the small scale cut flower trade, people who grow their own flowers for, you know, for their own florist business. And the other would be the stock, S-T-O-C-K. Stock is another cut flower that later became a bedding plant. The bedding plant version is fine, smells cool, and a nice little spot of color in the garden. The old-fashioned ones like the Cat's Hybrids and some of the others, 24 to 36 inches tall in bloom, long stems, super fragrant, fantastic for cutting, but they need that whole head start. So if you're into cut flowers, August is your month to get going on Snapdragon and stock.
Okay. You know, sometimes you go out and you go to pick the fruit. It's especially true of cherries, but mm-hmm. other fruit too. And they're twinned. They're two of them stuck together.
Yeah.
What's all that about twinning, Don?
Yeah, and the lady brought in an example of a peach. A lot of her peaches were two that developed right next to each other and were, you know, pressed up against each other, twinning of the fruit. And my recollection is that this is said to be caused by drought stress at the time that the fruit flowering buds are initiating in the late summer. So different fruit trees begin the differentiation of the cells into fruiting wood, flowering wood, at different times. In the case of walnuts, it's later in the season. In the case of almonds, it's August, September is my recollection. So it's really important in the case of almonds, right after they do a harvest, they haven't irrigated for 4 or 5 weeks because of the harvest operation, they immediately irrigate right away to make sure next year's crop will be good. Because if they don't, if they're drought stressed in the late summer, early fall with almonds, it can affect their crop by 20-30% or more the next year. In the case of peaches and cherries, it is believed that drought stress at that time, late summer into early fall, which is a common time for people to be inadvertently drought stressing their trees, increases the number of twinned fruit, where they're so close together that they're pressed against each other. The only problem with that is that in that point of contact, they're very vulnerable to pests and diseases getting in because there's moisture trapped in there. Earwigs like to crawl in there and feed. If you're going to have a problem, that's where it's going to occur. So a lot of the twinned fruit is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. You can eat it, but it's higher likelihood of having blemishes or actual insect injury.
So Don sent me a long time ago a list of my fall and winter planning sequence. Now, you got to say, come on, it's barely August. What are we talking about fall planting for? And the thing is that the earliest plantings that you do for the things you're growing in the winter are in July and August. Yeah. And that's Brussels sprouts, some of the cabbages, and Romanesco. So if you're into those things, check it out.
Don't forget, I realized I didn't even put this on here, rutabagas.
Oh, rutabagas?
Yeah, you got to get them in July. August is getting late for rutabagas.
But it's still July. We have one more day.
Just barely, yeah. So you do rutabagas, Brussels sprouts. When I say some cabbages, what I mean by that is that older cabbages, the real big-headed types, you needed to get in very early to get a big plant to form up a good size head for storage. This is what they're typically for, is cabbage you're going to keep in store for weeks, if not months. Modern cabbages will develop, you know, plant them in September, October, they'll be just fine. But some of the old-fashioned ones did need to go in early. Romanesco, you can plant as late as early November, but the earlier you get in, the bigger plants you'll get, the bigger heads you'll get. But it does work when you plant it later. But July, August, rutabagas, Brussels sprouts, long day cabbages, you know, long season cabbages, and Romanesco.
This is an article from the book, The Gardener's Guide to Life. In The Count of Monte Cristo, Alexandre Dumas wrote, quote, "All human wisdom is summed up in two words, wait and hope," unquote. And she says, this is spoken like a true gardener. Mother Nature moves at her own pace and will not be hurried by fretful humans. If you're anxious for a flower to bloom or a seedling to sprout, wait and hope. And then I quote to you from William Shakespeare, "Sweet flowers are slow, and weeds make haste."
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.